Hello and welcome to the Mystic Cast, where you join Jack Stafford and Deborah Littleboy, members of the Aetherius Society, the cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age, as we break down the barriers between religion, science, metaphysics, philosophy, and mysticism, all of which are really only aspects of the selfsame quest for truth. Please note, this is an independent program not produced or fact-checked by the Aetherius Society. Today, our guest is Peter Panagor. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Jack. Hi, Deborah. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to go deep into love. Love, love, love. Love is all you need. It's been sung about. It's been preached about. But probably there's not enough you can say about love. But maybe you can add a few more insights, which maybe people haven't heard. Kick us off with your insights and your mission as a knowing and inspirational messenger of the beloved near-death experiencer and international best-selling author.
I thought a lot about talking about the word love and using the word love, because love has 10,000 aspects for human beings. There's the love of a spouse to a spouse, or the parent to a child, or the child to a cousin, or the elderly to a cat. And none of these are the same. There's about 10,000, maybe more like 8 billion different forms of love, because we all experience it. It's subjective. It can't be named. When I say I love you, what does that mean? So even so, this word that has 10,000 meanings is the best word, I think, that there is. But it's only an approximation. The unconditional love that I experienced on the other side is the size of our universe times 100 other universes. And it contains all of the matter inside of all of them, and more into infinity, like the largest cosmic ocean you could imagine. And therefore, it is disproportionate to the human fractals of love that we experience here. They're of the same quality, but not nearly the same quality, unspeakable, ineffable, essentially unknowable by humans, but experiential in the divine energies that we communicate with between ourselves and in nature. But this unconditional love enfolds every molecule of our universe, and everything is made by it, and everything folds back into it. And nothing is ever lost. Love cannot lose itself.
Yeah, that fits so well with what we're told in one of our teachings called the Nine Freedoms, where we're explained that it's the third creative force. So from source, it's the third. It's the
Nine Freedoms.
It's the glue. It's the glue that So you get the divine creative force, and then that comes into manifestation. And the third creative force is actually the preservative force, which is love. So it's preserved. And then from there, we fractal out and it comes in then different, we're told in different octaves. But it is the same energy. There is only one energy, but it's at different, vibrates at different octaves. So what you explained there was what we have. We're told as well that we can use it as an energy, not as an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use it as an energy, so we use ourselves as a transmitter, a receiver, and a transmitter. We can bring in the highest or higher octaves. So we don't color it with our emotions. And then we can send it through to the higher devic kingdom, and it will be used then to balance disharmony, be it sickness within a person or a warring nation or an earthquake, whatever it is. This is the one energy that actually brings harmony. And so that all encompassing, and you can't really get to grips with it, but you can't get away from it because you're surrounded, and it is, and you are, it is just wonderful. So how do you, in your ministry, because you're reverent, yes, in your ministry, how do you convey that to your practitioners, to your parents?
Oh, it's a very good question. I, after my first NDE, I understood that I had a mission of communication, and that as an English major, I was a writing undergraduate, words were the mechanism of communication that I was studying and came to understand. But I understood in my NDE that words can never contain it. And so I was left with this conflict of this energy. I got extra dose when I came back. This energy that came back with me was telling me to communicate, but didn't give me any words. And so I went in the study of words of my entire life. I study communication, but that's an overlay. The same weaving that you describe is the same overlay that can transmit. So this energy, Shakti or Holy Spirit or divine energy transference, kind of lots of different names for this thing, but it can be contained in language. It can be put into paintings or baking and bread. It can be woven into the material world. And so I've been trying to weave it into my body so that it can speak without emotion through itself. And so as I try to work with the people that I've worked with, sometimes when I was in the church, I was a Protestant minister. As a non-believer, I need to say, because I know what, and the language can't contain, but I tried to use the Christian context to weave into the language and what I was teaching, that I saw that Jesus wasn't who they said he was. The light itself woven through the words that I spoke. These days, I do the same thing. I did it in television. I wove the light inside the words as I was on TV for a long time, and I wove the light inside the words. And then in my current work, I do the same thing. I try to have a practice of self-negation, of non-attachment, and a practice of gathering energy in order to step aside and let it through. And so I practice that. I'm practicing it now. I practice it every single time I try to communicate with anybody. Sometimes it's easier with others who are in the same octave as you, or at least attuned to the same scale. And so I try to teach tools of how to access it and get out of the way. And I try to deconstruct Christian theology through the lens of near-death experience and scholarship and storytelling. And I try to mostly do this thing. This is how I try to communicate it. Because if people can feel it for themselves, if you can experience this yourself, then it becomes real to you. And when it's real to a person, then they can pursue it on their own in their interior world. And they don't really need me anymore, because the big guru, it's its own teacher. It has led me on my path through my entire life. And the more I step aside, the better I am led, the better follower I become.
Brilliant. So two NEDs, did you say? Two NDEs, rather.
To one in 1980 from ice climbing in Western Canada during the winter, and the second of a congenital heart problem that is genetic in my mid-50s from a heart attack, a widowmaker heart attack. My cardiac doctor told me that I started making an excess amount of cholesterol the moment I was born. So there you go. No matter how much olive oil I eat, doesn't get rid of it. So yeah, I died twice. The first one was a much deeper and longer journey, and the second one was shorter, more shallow, but both completely life-changing.
And different.
Different. Oh, different. But there were similarities. There was overlap to them. But in the first one, I didn't know what was going on after I died. and resisted being taken. And in the second one, I knew, I waited for, I prayed for my entire life, 40 years praying for this thing, that I get taken. And so when I was taken, I was like, oh, this is great. I know exactly what's going on. Yeah. So they also overlapped in that I saw my, I chose to come back both times. And in the first event, I saw my parents' lives with me, two separate timelines for my parents' life, one with me and one without me. And I saw the same for my just born granddaughter and the second one, and was allowed to come back. I asked to come back. I was invited to stay. I was told both times that it was my time. And yeah, so I guess the last thing is the overwhelming level of love that pervades the depth of the who I am and my creative self. A very consistency, very deep consistency of that unconditional love, and the power of its welcome, light, mercy, intellect, and so much more.
So when you asked to come back, did you come back knowing that you needed, or it was your mission to explain to people what love was, is, how to use it?
And how to live it, how to be in it as much as one can while living in the turmoils and trials of real life with the DNA body that you have and the circumstances that you're in. So how do you embody this thing that is, it's not so much embodying it, although that's one way to talk about it. It's more of a decoupling from the egoic self, and allowing the space for it to reveal its already present. It's innate presence. And it can feel like an inflow or a swelling, but it's really a negation that allows more space into a place that it already is. But as a child, when I was 5, I had my first out-of-body heaven experience with the same angel, to give it a denoting, but it's so much more than what the history says. I knew as a child I worked for the divine. And then through my life, there was this long series of radical mystical experiences that reformed me every time and prepared me for this. And so I knew as I left this first NDE that I'd been preparing for this, and that it had long been my task, flawed as it is, to do the job that I've been doing since the moment I got back. And I resisted. When I came back here, I was like, wait a minute. I did not know that I would come back an entirely different person. I didn't understand that my perception of the world would be so radically shifted, that everything looked to me to be artificial, thin, frail, and false. And yet through that frailness, this same light or a lesser quantity of the same quality was pouring through everything and me, and that I didn't completely come back. I was like hanging above myself, looking through me in the world. And yet I, you know, every ache and pain, psychological, emotional, or physical, they, you know, manifested themselves for sure, and relational. So I was a reluctant, once I volunteered, I became reluctant. And yet I had this double compulsion. The loss of my beloved, what became the driver of my life. So I worked on an inward journey and an outward journey, inward being primary and outward being necessary and helpful. And even though my egoic mind was, Shakespeare, I was biting my thumb at heaven. because I was I felt tricked, even though I knew better. I felt like the divine didn't warn me of the radicalness of my transformation. Like I did not, can I go back and live my life? Then I choose to go back and live my life. No language, but that's the impression of my mind. And the voice said, yeah, you can go back, but you're not living your life. And it was like, so I came back without choice. I made my choice. And I had this, I came back with this compulsion. There was so much energy that it was, it was disruptive to everything about me. So in spite of myself, I went in deep pursuit because I had no other choice. So I went and I studied and I learned and I practiced and I lived karma yoga. I lived as a life of service as I tried to sacrifice myself interiorly for the abundance of love that I knew existed.
Yeah, we're told in our teachings that karma yoga is the yoga of this age. You can't, gone are the times and you can go and go away from humanity in a in a cave and cut yourself off. No, you have to do it in the clutter, and it's uncomfortable. And I mean, I've not had any experiences, anything like you've explained, David, Peter, but the fact is that even when I'm sending my energy out, when I'm bringing in the best I can and I'm sending it out to the world, when I come back from that space, everything is painful.
Mm-hmm.
Being around people is painful, and painful in a way that I just don't want to be around them at all. I know that's only like a fraction of what you're saying there, but I sort of get it. It's like this world is needing love, the higher octaves of love, so much. It's needing to know that it is love, and yet it's not. It's almost like a sponge that's full up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unable, physically unable to take it. So yeah, but there has to be a way through, because there has to be a way through, and we are the way through. So let's go back to Jesus, because you said, and I know what he is. Now I know what I've been told that. So can we compare some notes on?
Sure.
So you start.
Oh, okie doke. So I was raised Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox in both churches simultaneously. My parents, one was one and one was the other. And so I came to the understanding very early on that the churches each claimed to hold the ultimate truth, and both of them hated each other for not holding the other. So there was a conflict in my life, a religious conflict. But I went to Catholic school. And so I read each one of the Gospels, high school. I read a Gospel a year in my Catholic school. But I already had this like twisty thing inside me about, even though I had mystical experience, I was like, geez, the church, they both say that they know the truth and they're both pointing the finger at the other as a heretic. And so I died. And the church taught that they deified Jesus at the Council of Nicaea under Constantine, when Constantine was trying to consolidate his power across multiple nationalities and language forms in his empire. And he needed a through line in order to base his power. And they created a dynamic counterbalancing PowerPoint locus of power, of political power, and by creating the deification of Jesus and giving the power of transformation to the church itself. And that church, and the church became this concentration. And so they deified Jesus, but he didn't deify himself. He never considered himself to be what they thought he was. He was a oneness teacher. Make them one as you and I are one. Go inside your closet and pray. Make your eye single and your body will be filled with light. I can go through the whole scriptures, how anywhere you want to go, I can take a point and take a look and say, this is how he was an ultimate oneness teacher of enlightenment and trans heaven, brilliant light of being, but he was totally human and he knew it. And he was telling us that we are totally human and totally light as well. And we could have what he has. He kept telling us, you are the light of the world. You can do better than me.
Absolutely. And of course, he was a yogi adept. He walked on water, he had so he defied gravity, but he did say that this physical body is the same as your physical bodies. And this is what you can do with your physical bodies if you train it, if you open your heart, if you understand the oneness of all things. Yeah, we are also told that actually he came from Venus. So that's where we sort of divide somewhere along a line from a lot of people. We're told that a lot of the spiritual teachers come from other planets in our solar system. And Jesus, we're told, come from Venus. And we're told that Buddha came from Venus. We're told that Sri Krishna came from Saturn. But the element of what they were teaching was exactly what you're saying. It's the truth. They were teaching the truth.
and the truth
just got twisted for power. Which is such a sad, sad thing. We're also told that Jesus was actually walking the earth for 200 years after the resurrection. He was actually physically here teaching on earth, and he's in the higher realms now. And so Dr. King channeled him in 1958. We've got some beautiful teachings. And you've only got to read the teachings to know it's all about oneness and love, and you can feel the energy of it, and you can channel the energy of it. And that for me is the truth. Because knowing the teachings, though, so I've got them now. I understand the Bible better than I ever did before, because I just didn't, when I read it, I didn't understand it. And then knowing like the metaphysics behind it, things make so much, it's like a different story. And I want people to understand, to read it in the way that is the truth. But it's very, very difficult when we've got all this dogma and us against them and my dad's bigger than your dad mentality, which is, so sad. So if you was to tell our audience the best way to live a simple but loving life, I think you've already said it, from when you get up in the morning until you go back at night and course correct, is there a formula that you could give to us to if you want to tune yourself to the love energy?
Sure. Practice the presence of God in every breath that you can. And so I practice other kinds of yoga. I practice Kriya Yoga, which is a breath work, mental focus, separation of myself, my smaller self, from attachment to my egoic mind. And the practice of self-negation and the practice of Kriya Yoga, the just the forms that I practice, you can practice anything you want, They bring heaven here now. And so over a lifetime, 40 years of practice, I've created a cavern inside myself to which I return whenever I want to be back in the space of peace. And so I cultivate my karma yoga, which feeds my selfless practice through service. The meditation aspect of it empowers the karma yoga, and that comes back and empowers the meditation. But the meditation itself and the negation of self is the foundation, because I am the one in my own way. And as I step aside with practice again and again and again, I create this cavern for the light to live inside of. And then when I'm up in the morning and I go down and I get my coffee, I can, even while I read the news, I can have a space inside myself where I have retreated to, even while I read the news, the bad news. And then when I'm sitting and talking over the day with my wife, I can give her a kiss goodbye and have this presence of my interior peace with me. So the more I cultivate this interior peace on a daily basis with practice, the more it lasts through my day, the easier it is to dip back inside of as my day goes on, day after day after day after day.
So do you have a daily practice that starts on waking? Is that sort of, do you have a set format?
If you're looking for a set format of technique, yes. I don't do it at waking. I do it after. I do it mid-morning mostly. That's just my practice. And I have two basic practices. The yoga practice I'll talk about second. The primary practice comes through a mashup of Theravada Buddhism and Christian mysticism through the monastery near my Catholic high school, and it's called Centering Prayer Practice. And so back in the late 70s, I learned Centering Prayer Practice, which is also a practice of silence. It's a chant-based breath, mental focus, together breath technique, basically to the bottom of the belly and back up out the nose again. And when the mind wanders, come back to the prayer practice, the repetition of the phrase. And I use the Jesus prayer. So I repeat the Jesus prayer attached to my breath, and I stop my mind from thinking by forcing it to think on one thing. And I burn a tape loop in my consciousness, now over 40 years, where the prayer runs of its own accord always. And now I can dip back into it and bring it to the forefront of my mind and quiet myself whenever I want. And the purpose of that prayer is to step out of the way of the divine, to recognize that my egoic self is not me. I'm helping my egoic self understand that it is not me. I understand that, but it needs training. And so that's one part. And so I practice 20 minutes a day. And then throughout the day, whenever I want to take a breath. And then the Kriya Yoga practice comes out of the Yoga Sutras and Paramahansa Yogananda, autobiography of a yogi. And I was fortunate to learn Hatha Yoga early on, and the two back in 1980, and the two forms linked, I linked them together, the Kriya Yoga and the Hatha Yoga. And so I practiced a breath form with my body as the mantra. And my body became took up the space of the language, and I used my mind to find my subtle body, to access my chakras, it was an instantaneous access to my chakras the moment I was shown where they were. And so I came back with this extra dose inside of me that I've been cultivating this and connecting them and creating a larger and larger space. And I talk about the space as an interior space, but it's expansive now for me. The space is much bigger than I am. And it turns out that it's not so much that I inhabit my body as my body inhabits me, and that that my body can be trained through breath, body and mental focus practices to engage with my higher self. And so I practiced for years. Right now, my Hatha yoga has fallen off. My Kriya yoga continues in a sitting form. But for about 3 decades, I practiced an hour every day of Hatha yoga and then would top it off by 20 minutes of meditation. And I found that the practice of the breath and body powered my mental sitting practice with extra juice. And then, you know, life changed. I had a heart attack. That's really what changed everything. My heart attack made my body less responsive. I have extra problems that I didn't have before. And so I've modified my practice to less Hatha and more mental focus, chi, prana movement. And I teach that as well.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? When you've said that you can access and you know exactly where your chakras are, can you physically close, so open and close them and send the energy through? Is that so? If you wanted higher energy, do you instruct the root and the sacral to close so that you've got a pressure of energy going through? Is that how it works?
No, not really. It's uncomfortable when I close them. When I close them, I go blind. And so I've been working the opposite of that, because when they're open, I can see. And so, but I do use my root and my sacral, and what I learned in my Hatha practice. So all this practice was private. No, I didn't tell anybody. I was on my own doing this. I was working in the Christian church, practicing Eastern techniques. There was nobody to talk to about this. So I was like on my own. And so I learned through martial arts that if I used compression in my root, when I would get in a stance, I would compress my root with my stance, that I could take the energy there and, yes, drive it upward. But I wasn't closing it so much as compressing it. So I would use my muscular structure to, and I still do this, even in sitting. So when I'm sitting, I can use my glutes and my pelvic floor. I can open them up when I breathe in. And then I can crush them. And as I crush the muscles, as I go up to my sacral, I compress the energy that's there and I drive it upward. And then I can relax and let it pour down, or I can gather above. And with a compression, but it creates less breath, I can keep the compression and drive the whole thing down into the space that I've compressed, because the energy that is there isn't constrained by my body. I use my body to feel the space. And my whole practice wasn't about... So when I began this practice, I read a whole ton of work for years. But when I began the Hatha Kriya Chakra practice, I made a decision because they were real to me immediately. And I could tell you the story of how that happened. And I was in front of a class of people in my university with one of my teachers and who demonstrated. Anyway, I don't need to tell you the story. So
you might have to, because you piqued my interest, but carry on.
All right. Well, I'll start there then and come back to where I was. So when I came back, I was in the National Student Exchange Program from my public university to another public university when I died. And when I came back to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, 30,000 students, I continued my study of theater. So I was an English major, but I had just finished a national tour in a theater company that was associated with this other university. And the theater company was in sign language and in mime. And I was one of two mimes out of a cast of maybe 15 people. Mm-hmm. And so I continued my study of mime when I got back to UMass, and my mime teacher had studied in the school of Marcel Marceau. And Marcel Marceau taught Hatha yoga. So every single mime class began with Hatha yoga, which is totally new to me. Like, I didn't know from Atha. And so in this class one day, he put us in a posture and sitting on the floor, my right foot was out at an angle. My feet were pointed to the ceiling. My foot was pointed to the ceiling. My left foot was tucked into my groin with my left foot tucked. My left foot was in my groin, tucked against my arm, bent at the knee. And I was sitting straight. And he had us breathe into our sacral with a cupped hand below, to breathe into our sacral with a cupped hand above. And then he said, feel your palms with your mind. And there was a ball of energy in my hands. And then he said, raise that hand up, turn it, you know, past my heart, past my head, up into the air. And as I'm doing this, I'm feeling like thick taffy, like this ball of energy didn't deplete. It just expanded into a rod, like taffy, like it was kind of wobbly. And so then he said, okay, class, who felt anything? Did anybody feel something? What'd you feel? Did you feel a tingle? And I raised my hand and nobody else did. And he said, okay, Peter, come up front. And so I went up front and I'm feeling kind of weird. And he says, kneel. So I kneel down and he kneels in front of me and he says, put up your palms. I put up my palms. He said, close your eyes. I close my eyes. And he said, what do you feel? And I said, I feel pinwheels this way. Now, what do you feel? I feel pinwheels this way, and then this way, and then that way, and then none. He said, open your eyes. And I opened my eyes, and his palms were an inch from mine. And the whole class was in, like, couldn't believe what they had just seen, that I mimicked him with my eyes closed. And so he said to me, how did you learn that? I said, I don't know, because I knew, but I wasn't going to say a word. And so I decided that I wasn't going to learn anything intellectual about chakras, that they would teach me if I could access them. And so I didn't study their names or their sounds or their colors or who said what about them, or I just went in pursuit of them. I looked at a chart to know where to peek. And then with Yogananda's advice of riding my spine, which I began the practice of, and then the Yoga Sutras, which had tons of advice, I just embarked on my own practice and let them reveal themselves to me and learned how to stack them, how to connect them, how to expand them, how to get out of the way of them, how to run them to my palms, run it to my feet, run it around my body. And and I knew that there was a problem with Kriya Yoga. And the problem with Kriya Yoga, which is why it's the most dangerous form, is because it can lead to misuse. It can be like the dark side of the force. So the practice of self-negation was an equal necessity in order, because I wasn't trying to project myself. I already knew that I'm not me. I know I'm not me. This thing, I have to train it so that it gets out of the way. And so this practice of these two practices, the stepping aside and the energizing or the creating the space for the energy to come into me, became what we talked about in the beginning, became the opportunity for me to try to, stepping aside, let it flow from me. There came a point at which the outward tap opened. And when the outward flow tap opened, the inward one got wider and the flow just continued. And so that wasn't so many years ago, as a result of another mystical experience that was accentuated by my second NDE. And it was after my second near-death experience that I was able to finally understand that the techniques that I learned as a youth actually worked. And I knew that they worked because when after my heart attack, I had another accident that took me out for another 5 months. It was something physical that happened. And so then I began to practice yoga on my own. And at the same time, my TV show had ended. The new corporation had botched the station and my 15 years of television were over. And so I was on severance trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And so I was finally well enough to do my yoga practice again, you know, my body. And I ran into one of my teachers, a yoga teacher in town. She has a studio and I got lonely practicing on my own. And she let me and all the teachers in the town let me practice my own yoga, following along with them in the class, everything. So I would go to the back of the class and I'd mostly follow along, but they let me do my own thing. And she said, when are you coming back to class? And I said, probably not coming back to class. She said, no, we want you back. I said, nah, you know, I got my own thing going on now. And she said, when you're in class, everybody experiences the change in the room. Your energy, and everybody knows this, and nobody, so it's like 40 people in these classes, and not all at once, but 40 people in town, at least 40 people go. And your presence changes our experience. And it was at that moment, only a few years ago, that the promise that I made to myself in that mime class way back when I first practiced yoga was that either it was going to show itself to me and grow on its own, or it wasn't going to. And I was never going to talk about it until it became an experience that others had from, and not from me, because that's the wrong, that means the wrong thing. That it flows of it. Say.
As a result of what as you were doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, the practice.
So that's karma yoga, Peter. So Kriya turned into karma yoga because you're giving service to 40 people.
And in a practical sense, as a minister, I incorporated karma yoga, although I never call it that, into Christian service and helped people serve others. Service. Mm-hmm. You know, serve the poor. So I worked, the last church I worked in was pretty wealthy. And, but also I lived, there were a lot of poor people in town. It was not a wealthy enclave. So I got the wealthy to give their money to the poor. But to do it through charitable service, but also through action. And to be present in the food pantry, to collect the food, to distribute it, all sorts of stuff like that. Because there's this natural outflow of love into the world once you step aside. And as this flow, as you see the other person as the light itself, then there's this natural connection, and this natural connection comes with compassion and kindness. And so then that flows back in. And when you recognize it's this two-level thing, seeing the divine light inside of all and recognizing their brokenness is the same as my brokenness. This radical equality of the overflowing light and the mud, dirt, human self. And so karma yoga then becomes a societal function. And at its best, I'd say church is very good at karma yoga, or it can be. Certain churches can be very good, or sections of churches can be good at karma yoga, even though they never call it that.
No, but it doesn't matter what you call it, as long as it's done.
Yeah, that's right. What's in a name?
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating. Thank you, Peter. So over to you, Jack.
Yeah, it's been beautiful. I mean, thank you so much for sharing your practical insights. It's been wonderful. We really must get you back on the show. In the meantime, where can people follow you?
PeterPanagor.love. PeterPanagor.love is my website. You can contact me there. And I do a lot of counseling to help people integrate their mystical experiences. And on my YouTube channel, Peter Panagor.
Wonderful. We'll put the links in the show notes. People can find it there. I wanted to read, I've been reading your website, and you've done a wonderful job of articulating the unarticulable experiences. You've written beautiful words about how we're birthed by love and spoken into being. I wanted to read a little bit from the second freedom, because you would get so much from it. I really recommend you get this book and read Dr. King's commentary on it. Just the words on love, I think you would really appreciate them.
Thank you. I think I may have a copy of it in my attic. The Antherius Society is not new to me. I did lots of exploration, and I'm pretty sure I have a copy.
Oh, well, check it out. The Second Freedom, if you haven't got it, get it. Because I've been told not to bat people over the head with the book. Deborah's given me specific instructions not to be too much of a preacher. But I'm not worrying, the audience, if they want it, they can get it. But I think you would, as someone of your level, would really benefit from, would really.
I'm a reader.
Lift those words, yeah. Wonderful. Well, if people want to learn about the Aetherius Society, they can go to aetherius.org. Thanks again, Peter.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Peter. Been wonderful. Thank you.